It's down to the final weekend of the 2014 campaign. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, where we discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making headlines. Governor Scott and Governor Crist make last-minute pitches as more than 2 million Floridians already have voted. But this is Florida, and this is an extremely tight race for governor. What happens if there's a recount? Plus, a New York Times investigation examines relationships between corporate cash, lobbyists, and state attorneys general, including Florida's own Pam Bondi. And it was 5 years ago this weekend, Scott Rothstein's $1 billion Ponzi scheme began to unravel. What's been the impact on South Florida and its reputation? It's all ahead on this Halloween edition of the Florida Roundup next. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN, the Halloween edition. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Well, it's not scary. Instead, almost 2.5 million Floridians already have voted as the final weekend of the 2014 campaign is here now. An estimated 10,000 attack ads have been unleashed during this final week, and the feds are watching on the lookout for voting rights abuses in the Sunshine State. So welcome to it, modern day election day in Florida. Have you voted? What are the issues motivating you to go to the ballot box early? Is it the economy? Maybe education? How about health care? The environment? Medical marijuana? Let us know. Join in here on the Florida Roundup, a Halloween Election Eve edition. The phone number is 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. You can also join us on Twitter at WLRN or go live to the website to participate in our live chat at WLRN.org. Sergio Bustos is the political editor at the Miami Herald. He joins us from the Herald newsroom. And Steve Bosquet covers politics for the Tampa Bay Times with us from Tallahassee. Sergio, let's start with you here. What do we know about who already has voted in this election?
Well, by Election Day, we'll have probably more than, well, close to half the actual voters come in. Last time in 2010, about 5.3 million voters, and more than 2 million voted early. And that was with fewer voting days, mm-hmm. early voting days. What we know now is right now, as usual, Republicans do very well with the absentee ballots, even though registered Democrats outnumber Republicans. So there's a race for Republicans to get as many in as possible. And then there's a race for Democrats to get as many people to the polls as possible on Tuesday. And both sides are really cranking out to get out the vote.
Yeah, they certainly are. Sergio, I'm going to have you back away from the microphone there a little bit in Doral. Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times, 17% of these early voters are identified as independents. That seems unusually large.
It is. You know, the unaffiliated voter is by far the fastest growing segment of the electorate. There are about now about one of every four voters in Florida registers and rejects both political parties. And these are voters who are considered free agents. They're considered unlikely voters, and they're proving that perception wrong in this election because they're showing up in bigger numbers than is anticipated all over the state. Most polling shows that Charlie Crist has a slight edge over Rick Scott among independent voters.
And the independent voters are the ones that obviously one would argue mathematically will decide this race. Steve, just how close is it as we enter into this final weekend?
It's pretty close. Every poll is 1% either way with a 3% margin of error. You know, there's likely to be a as there often is in these close races, there's going to be a movement of voters in one direction or the other in the final 48 hours because, again, as Sergio pointed out, this is going to be the first general election in the history of Florida where a majority of votes will have been cast before Election Day. This race should break or come close to 6 million voters. So, which means you're going to have about 3 million people voting on Election Day. That's still have a lot of voters.
That is, and I want to return to that comment, Sergio. Let that sink in, right? More than half of the votes that will be cast and counted on the night of Tuesday night will have been cast before Election Day even comes, the official day, that first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. That changes campaigning significantly and has continued to change the tone and the tenor of this campaign.
Yes, you really don't have a traditional election day in Florida. To borrow a phrase from our political writer, Mark Caputo, you have election days. Mm-hmm. I mean, begins several weeks in advance. And what's unusual about this campaign is this thing has been going on forever. And we almost skipped the primary. The primary seemed to be kind of a little bump in the road. But this campaign started in earnest almost 9 months ago.
It certainly did. And in the meantime, both candidates do not necessarily have high approval ratings. University of Florida Bob Graham Center for Public Service, a poll out here, Steve, found the approval rating for Governor Scott handling his job just 44% approve of his handling his job of governor. Only 48% say they approved of Governor Crist 4 years ago when he was in Tallahassee. We've marked almost with regularity on Fridays and on Saturdays here on the Florida Roundup of the high disapproval ratings for either of these candidates. It's a race for who do you like least.
That's right. We've had reporters at early voting sites in Tampa Bay all week, and a common refrain among voters is it's a lesser of two evils election. It's also unusual, and it's unique in the history of the state, that we have, in effect, two incumbents running against each other,
mm-hmm.
the preceding governor, Charlie Crist, and the current governor, Rick Scott. You're right. You know, when this race began, Charlie Crist's positive rating was much higher than it is. You've seen the effect of Rick Scott's advertising campaign has had the effect the Republicans wanted. It's driven Charlie Crist's negatives really high. And I would anticipate if we get a clear-cut decision here on Tuesday night, you know, if there's a clear winner, more so than in recent governor's races we've covered, about half of the people are going to be not just disappointed, they're going to be angry and appalled by the result because voters on each side don't like the other guy intensely.
And we've had former Governor Graham on WLRN talk about how whomever wins on election night will not go into their next administration with any kind of clear mandate, certainly from the voters of Florida. We are talking on the Florida Roundup of the governor's race here on the eve of election weekend. Steve Bosquet with the Tampa Bay Times and Sergio Bustos, political editor at the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson. This is your program as well. Join us at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or tweet us at WLRN. Consistently, the singular most important issue that voters have identified heading into the election cycle has been the economy and jobs. Mark joins us on the Florida Roundup from Miami. Mark, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, and good morning, gentlemen. I called in because, you know, you asked what the motivation behind my going out and make sure I voted early was because of the economy. But then listening to your previous comments, I just like to, you know, change it just a moment. I don't trust either party, Democrat or Republican. I consider myself an independent. And then, yes, this is an election about the lesser of two evils. And, you know, the thing of it is, I think more and more Americans are becoming I'm starting to realize that the politicians, no matter how much rhetoric they spew out, are not looking out for their best interests. These party alignments are just foolish. You know, you have these diehard Democrats and diehard Republicans who are dying out, and the younger generation realize that both parties are failing the American people, you know, and it's just ridiculous. But as far as my reason for voting for, my reason for going out to vote, is because I truly feel like if the Republicans go in with their so-called policy procedures of cutting spending without bringing in revenue, then, you know, I just don't see how that's going to benefit the economy. Because I'm out here working two part-time jobs. I'm going to school full-time trying to improve my situation. It's rough out here, man. It's rough.
All right, Mark, we got it. It's rough out there. Mark from Miami voting on the economy. Kathleen joining us here on the Florida Roundup from Hollywood. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak. My name's Kathleen. I'm a registered Republican. I am a small business owner. And the reason that I'm very excited about voting this year is because I'm absolutely in disgust with the way Governor Scott has handled all the deaths related to DCF, all the deaths and cover-ups in the Department of Corrections, and the way they just want to send all these nonviolent drug offenders to jail.
So as a registered Republican, Kathleen, you are voting not for your party's candidate at the top of the ticket.
I cannot. This governor lacks compassion.
Kathleen, we got it. Thank you so much for joining the conversation here. Sergio, we haven't necessarily heard in any of the three debates a real significant conversation about some of the administrative problems that the Scott administration has encountered, certainly in its last year here, not only with the Innocence Lost investigation from your newspaper, the Miami Herald, and the deaths of kids that are supposed to be under the watch of the Department of Children and Families, but also, you know, the continued investigation into guard behavior at Florida prisons.
Well, yeah, both those issues are big stories that we did at the Miami Herald, and they just don't fit neatly into a soundbite. And again, as Steve was mentioning, you know, the airwaves have been bombarded by these 30-second messages and attacks on each other. And, you know, if the negative messages didn't work, they wouldn't use them. But I think they are very effective in driving at least the debate. What is curious, too, is those issues, again, don't even fit very well with the three debates that were held. Again, kind of more profound issues that are hard to kind of whittle down to just a few remarks, but very, nonetheless very serious.
Yeah, I'd like both of your reactions to what you have heard of the differences in these campaigns and from these candidates on some of these big issues. I mean, we know, for instance, on minimum wage, which hasn't been necessarily significantly talked about in this campaign, but Governor Crist is for raising it to $10.10 an hour. Governor Scott has opposed raising the minimum wage beyond where it is now. Governor Scott has not actively worked for Medicaid expansion, though he says he is for it. Governor Crist has said he will use an executive action if elected, if he can, to expand Medicaid as soon as possible. Governor Crist has talked about easing the Cuban trade embargo. Governor Scott has not. They've talked about immigration. Is it your sense, Steve Busquet with the Tampa Bay Times, that the significant ideological and operational differences between these two campaigns and these two candidates has come out?
I think so, if people are paying close attention. There's been too much negative 30-second attack ads, you know, bombarding the public and not enough serious discussion of issues. But you hit on some of the good issues, Tom. There's others. The last caller talked about nonviolent offenders being in the Florida prison system. That's a fact. Charlie Crist, if he's elected, is going to try to go back to a more liberalized version of restoring civil rights to people who've been released from the prison system. That's a stark difference between Rick Scott and Charlie Crist right there. And make no mistake, Charlie Crist, running as a Democrat, is backed strongly by labor unions, by personal injury lawyers, trial lawyers. You're going to see a significant shift to the left with many policies in Tallahassee if Crist wins the election.
Sergio, if Crist wins the election, a policy shift to the left compared to maybe a Governor Scott administration, compared to a Crist 1.0 administration? Sergio, did we lose you?
Go
ahead, Sergio.
Yeah, in terms of Scott, you're going to get more of the same. He said he will continue to focus on jobs and the economy. You know, he's held any number of news conferences when any time a company moves into the state, and that's been his kind of laser focus this whole time. As for Crist, I think he'll obviously move to the left, but you remember as a governor, he was very much a centrist.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to see far left. You're talking about center and far and moving to the right a little bit with either one.
4 years ago, Governor Scott defeated Democrat Alex Sink by fewer than 62,000 votes out of almost 5.5 million cast. University of South Florida professor Susan McManus.
A lot fewer people say that they're interested in voting because they feel like they can't really find out who's telling the truth. There's no one really talking about what to do looking forward that will make many of these casual voters' life better.
So we know it's going to be a tight turnout. It is going to be a tight race. The campaign sense how close it is, gearing up with lawyers and consultants preparing for a recount and a possible challenge. Steve, are there automatic triggers to a recount?
Yes, there are. And critics say the triggers are too high. That is, it's too difficult to get a contested election resolved quickly in this state. First of all, you have to have half of 1% or less dividing the two candidates. The math is very easy. Again, using that base of 6 million potential voters, Crist and Scott would have to be separated by 30,000 votes or less.
Half of what the margin was 4 years ago.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And then if that happens, then every supervisor begins to retabulate and basically refeed all those optical scan ballots through the machines, and they retabulate the count. And it would have to result in a difference of 0.25%. Now we're down to 15,000 votes. And then you start having a manual review of overvoted and undervoted ballots all over the state.
Now, in the meantime, we know that the Department of Justice is looking at Florida this election cycle. Back in August, the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder sent a letter to Governor Scott saying that his department will be, quote, carefully monitoring Florida voting. Steve, what does that mean?
Well, first of all, you know, Republicans think this is politically motivated by the Obama administration, and they say absolutely it is not. They're just doing their job. But you've got to look at the backdrop here of the last 3 or 4 years in the tension between the White House and Rick Scott's administration. There have been two attempts to purge non-citizens from the rolls. There have been other that we've gone back and forth with a number of early voting days. It took a Herculean effort by supervisors of election to get the legislature to expand the sites that can be used for early voting. Now we have reached a point, I think, in this state where, as Sergio pointed out, people have been voting in this state for the past month.
Yeah.
Absentee ballots went out several weeks ago. So people have ample opportunity to vote in the state of Florida. But Holder and the U.S. Department of Justice don't like what they've seen in Florida, and they issued that statement just as a we're watching you sort of advisory.
As a precautionary advisory, maybe. Steve Bosquet with the Tampa Bay Times, Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald here on the Florida Roundup. Richard is joining the conversation from Miami. Richard, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. Not only talking about the governor, but I just want to mention something that's been kind of like dismissed, which is the voter fraud and voter ID question. I was an assistant clerk at a precinct in Miami-Dade County 2 years ago, and someone who I know personally came in to vote, and I know that they live out of the district. They gave 4 different addresses until they hit one that was the right place to vote so they could vote for their friend. My dilemma was, do I call them out on a federal offense, or do I just ignore it because I know them as a friend?
And how did you respond, Richard?
I left it alone because I know them as a friend. My kids know their kids. But at the same time, when I've told the Miami-Dade Election Board, when I've reported it to a couple of Miami-Dade commissioners, because that is voter fraud, what they're looking for with ID, they just, oh, okay, yeah, we'll take a look. And it's been nothing. And they keep saying that, no, you don't need ID because there's no such thing as voter fraud at the polls.
So it seems troubling, Richard, certainly that individual story. And it is. Did you get a sense anything like that, though, was systemic?
People come in left and right when you're actually inside the polls working. You see people come in and they just go with an address. Oh, yeah, whatever. And you know they're at a different address, or they don't know their address. They can't go back and forth. And without the voter ID, a photo, an actual issue, which has something to verify, there's no way to justify. And there's cross lines. So it is occurring. And a voter ID is important. And they talk about it as far as disenfranchising.
Well, Richard, thanks for your service as an election clerk. Are you serving this cycle as well?
No, I'm not doing this cycle. I'll be doing the next one.
All right, Richard, joining the conversation from Miami. Sergio, we are prepared for these kinds of stories to come out. You know, Tuesday certainly is. We're expecting a large, we're expecting some kind of turnout. But there's always trouble around Election Day, and Florida, let's face it, has a very troubled history when it comes to fast and accurate counts.
Yeah, and I think historically, you got to keep in mind that. The kind of fraud that happens on Election Day may sometimes be overblown. I think the real fraud takes place with absentee ballots is always the troubling problem because they're done individually. There's ways to get ballots to people. There's a lot more, I guess, avenues to commit fraud with absentee ballots as opposed to someone coming the day of the election and, you know, trying to vote several times or the like, or appearing at the wrong precinct. Keep in mind that during early voting, you can go to any precinct,
right.
Any of the early voting locations.
Right, kind of open voting. We heard a prediction of a 6 million turnout vote by the time we get to Tuesday. Anybody disagree with that kind of heft of turnout? 4 years ago, I believe, it was about 5.5 million.
No, not at all. I was just going to mention, Tom, that and what Steve said about 6 million votes and that margin that would prompt a recount. We had one pollster tell us that they're expecting this election to be even closer than Bush-Gore in 2000. And if you recall that one, there was only a 537-vote margin, well within the recount margin, if that's true.
Steve, I just have to ask, Wednesday morning, will we know who the next governor of Florida will be?
If I had the answer to that, I'd bottle it, and I'd be at an intersection in Fort Lauderdale, probably. But I seem to think that it's more likely than not that we'll have an outcome. But as I pointed out in a nightmare scenario story for the Herald and Times this week, if it's really close on election night, the guy who's behind is not going to want to concede because. You know, the level of emotional and financial investment these two guys have in winning this election is immense, and their supporters. So it would have to be a clear-cut result. And by the way, again, because we have so many people voting absentee and early in this election, as a universe of the voters, you're going to see fairly early on election night a lot of votes showing up on the on that election night website the Department of State has. And so, you know, if one person gets out to a 60, 70, 80,000 vote lead, he's likely to be able to hold it all the way through.
Well, it also depends on where those returns are coming in from and what we can discern in terms of what that'll mean as we get on into the wee hours of the morning come Wednesday. Steve Bosquet with the Tampa Bay Times, Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald. The Florida Roundup will continue in a moment. The race to be Florida's top lawyer and Attorney General Pam Bondi's connection to lobbyists. Back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. An election eve here in Florida, although early voting has been underway for many, many days. Peter sending us this tweet at WLRN saying, I voted at the Lemon City Library. No wait. Voters outside were discussing their no votes on the Miami-Dade County Courthouse bond question. Plenty of those local issues on the ballots in your neighborhood. And among the big state questions, of course, is the race for governor, but also the race for attorney general. Millions of dollars in outside money has been spent during this election cycle here in the Sunshine State, including money for Attorney General Pam Bondi. She's running for re-election against Democrat George Sheldon. $750,000 has come from the Republican Attorneys General Association, which receives money from outside law firms and corporations. Now, a New York Times investigation published this week examined the relationship between corporate cash, lobbyists, and state attorneys general, including Florida's Pam Bondi. Eric Lipton headed up that investigation for the New York Times, and he joins us via the Times Bureau in Washington, D.C. via Skype. Eric, your investigation focused on a singular Washington, D.C. law firm. How does this firm work with state attorneys general?
Traditionally, you think that a law firm that's representing a major corporation, there's a lawsuit. It then, you know, sits down at a table and negotiates an attempt to get a settlement, or then it appears in court to defend the company against the allegations. In this case, this law firm it works very hard to build relationships, very personal relationships with the attorney generals. It makes donations to them. It invites them to dinners. It sponsors events at which they can appear and raise their national profile. And, they socialize with them. They go to resort destinations with them. Mm-hmm. And they really get to know them, and they try to change their sort of approach to the company by making them friends, almost.
Remind me the name of the law firm again.
It's Dickstein Shapiro.
Dickstein Shapiro, the name of that firm. And so is this kind of a new entree into lobbying essentially the top prosecutors in state, treating them as political animals, as would the chief executive of a state, like a governor?
I think that traditionally when the laws were written to dictate when lobbyists must register, they anticipated that lobbyists would be targeting legislators and governors mostly. And so they didn't, in most states, there isn't explicit requirements to register if you are communicating as a lawyer with the attorney general, even if it's not in the confines of a lawsuit. So this is a practice that has exploded in the last decade or so as the attorney generals have become more aggressive in terms of collecting significant fines from major corporations, pharmaceutical companies, financial services companies, internet companies. And so corporate America is basically woken up and realized these guys are a major threat to our bottom line, and we need to engage them like we lobby Congress and legislatures, and you know, we need to try to turn this around.
Eric Lipton from the New York Times with us here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald and Steve Bosquet with Tampa Bay Times continue with us. Sergio, to that last point that Eric makes in terms of kind of the controlling legal authority in terms of lobbying attorneys general, what do we know about this D.C. law firm and its lobbying efforts for the Sunshine State, for Pam Bondi specifically?
Well, a very, very good article by the New York Times on this, a really eye-opening. We checked out to see if any of them were actually registered and found that none of the partners at Dixting Shapiro were registered to lobby in Florida, which means they could be violating state law. But again, you've got this fine line between someone actually, a lawyer seeking remedy on some kind of court case and actual lobbying for legislation. What I find fascinating about the whole thing is essentially these folks that are trying to influence the attorneys general are going on working vacations with them, and that's pretty disturbing.
Yeah, describe a scene, Eric. I mean, you talk about it in the in your article, a scene at the, I believe it's the Hotel Coronado, a very famous kind of, you know, turn of the last century resort in San Diego, and this scene of, you know, great opulence, essentially, in these conference rooms.
They weren't conference rooms. It was bars and pools and beaches and sailboats. It was extraordinary. The New York Times put up the money to send me to the beach villas at the Dell, which is a place where the rooms cost as much as $4,500 a night. You need it's a compound, and you need a key card to get into this private resort, which is next door to the Coronado. So the Coronado is actually cheap compared to the beach villas of the Dell. And the attorney generals were all there. I mean, about a dozen of them, all Republican attorney generals, because this was a Republican attorney general conference. And then, you know, there was Pfizer, there was Comcast, there was Altria, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Dixting Shapiro. And, you know, they were there having breakfast together while the seagulls were coming down, and the Wisconsin attorney general was, like, trying to get the seagulls to go away. They were sitting at the bar having drinks. They were, you know, then they went, played golf. They went sailing. They went to a Padres game. And it was really, you know, and there was no real work. I mean, I didn't observe any work going on.
Yeah,
it was a resort weekend.
I've got to ask you, Eric, right. I mean, were there, you know, seminars of, you know, some kind of legal education or, you know, understanding the latest Dodd-Frank financial services regulation and how it applies to financial regulation in your state? I mean, those kinds of things that you would normally have with a seminar.
Yeah. No, this was what's called the Edmund Randolph Club. If you are a Comcast or the Chamber of Commerce or Altria, you have to write a $125,000 check, and then you get invited to this extended resort weekend, which is a pre-meeting before the conference, in which they actually do have some seminars where people sit down and talk about legal issues. But this was simply a get-together. And if you pay $125,000, you essentially buy access to these attorney generals to be able to socialize with them for a long weekend. Or it was a pre-weekend. It was during the work week, actually. Mm-hmm. And Pam Bondi was reimbursed $6,500 from RAGA for this trip, which included several thousand dollars just for the room she was staying
in. RAGA is the Republican Attorney General.
You know, it's in a confident.
RAGA is the Republican Attorneys General.
Yeah, Republican Attorney General Association. Yeah. So it was a very nice place. Yeah.
Steve Bosquet with the Tampa Bay Times. You know, Eric makes a point about these corporations, to some degree, discovering the pull that attorneys general can have in a state. Arguably, there have been these large master settlement agreements with big national legal issues that certainly date back to the late 1990s with the large tobacco settlement that Florida played a leading role in. So I'm curious, you know, is Steve, as you've, you know, read through the New York Times piece and understand, you know, the Pam Bondi relationship that's laid out here, what are some of those kind of big national issues that you see at play and you see coming through the Republican Attorneys General Association here in Florida?
I can speak to that.
Go ahead, Sergio.
You know, let me just put this in perspective for listeners out there. Imagine, if you will, you're really annoyed with a telemarketer, and you decide you want to complain to the Attorney General's office here in Florida. Imagine again that you're really angry and that you actually go up to the Breakers and have a couple drinks with Pam Bondi, and she hears you out and maybe does something about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the equivalent of what's being done on a much larger scale with millions of dollars at stake. And as for Florida, one of the most interesting cases involved the whole idea of taxing these internet travel companies like right. Travelocity and the like. Mm-hmm. They were able to persuade Bondi's office to release that and not to pursue it any further. And there had been some efforts on the legislative front, too, that also got dropped. And this was saving these companies tens of millions of dollars. Now, some counties have actually continued that legal action. That's still pending.
Now, the Attorney General has released a statement in response, Eric, to your article saying, quote, "My office aggressively protects Floridians from unfair and deceptive business practices, and absolutely no access to me or my staff is going to have any bearing on my efforts to protect Floridians." So Eric Lipton with the New York Times not denying access, but saying that access doesn't necessarily influence any action that Pam Bondi, as the state top prosecutor, or any of the hundreds of attorneys that work for her, would take on behalf of Floridians.
I mean, the biggest issue, I think, is when the companies that are the targets of investigation are contributing, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars, mostly tens of thousands of dollars, to RAGA and DAGA while the investigations are going on. And then they're going to these resort destinations and chit-chatting with Dixie and Shapiro representing them or other firms with the attorney generals outside of the office in settings where the line attorneys who are actually heading the investigations are not present, and talking to them and trying to essentially convince them to back down. And that seems like a weird thing to be doing at the beach villas at the Dell,
yeah.
You know, and it's just weird.
And so, you know, Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald mentioned the Travelocity and Priceline cases being dropped when Pam Bondi got into the Attorney General's office. There have been other cases, Eric, in regards to for-profit education and healthcare bill collecting. Have you been able to draw any conclusions between, you know, the dollars at play, the lobbying that's happening, either legally defined as lobbying or some other influence, and the action that the Attorney General here in Florida has taken with some of these cases, including healthcare bill collection and for-profit colleges?
I mean, mostly regarding Florida was a series of matters that Dixie and Shapiro represents major corporations, and that the state did not take up. It did not initiate investigations. And then there was the one situation regarding online hotel booking companies, in which it actually did drop an investigation. It closed the case before it actually reached the judge. And so, you know, one of the biggest powers of all that an attorney general has is which company to investigate. Yeah. I mean, they have incredible discretion. And that is, you know, that's their biggest power of all. And so if you as a law firm can convince them to pass, that's, you've had an incredible victory. But that's very hard to measure. You know, who do you attribute that to?
Right.
Can the state simply say, well, we haven't received many complaints, and, you know, and we didn't, the evidence justifying an investigation was not sufficient. Well, that's impossible, really, to measure.
What was the relationship, Eric, that you found with Brightpoint Education, one of those for-profit education companies that has been, you know, under scrutiny nationally, including here in Florida?
Yeah, I think it's Bridgepoint, I think.
Bridgepoint, yes.
Right. I mean, what I found was that there were at least four states which described, you know, pretty significantly, you know, serious behavior that they felt was worthy of investigation. One, including Iowa, that had a settlement with a significant, you know, fine being paid. And then Dixie and Shapiro set up a meeting with Bondi's office and brought in the senior executives from the for-profit college and essentially, you know, encouraged them not to initiate their own investigation. And the state did not. Now, again, I mean, you know, Bondi's office said to me, and I don't have no reason to believe, you know, to not believe them, that they have not received many specific complaints mm-hmm. about that for-profit college. And that was the reason that they did not initiate an investigation. One of the things that tends to happen is when once one or two states get, you know, significant penalties from companies, it's essentially an invitation to the other states, you know, if the similar activity was occurring in their state,
right,
to just initiate their interaction, because it's essentially money that's on the table for them to collect at that point.
Yeah, and we saw that certainly at play with the tobacco lawsuit back in the 90s, no doubt about it. Here on the Florida Roundup, that's Eric Lipton with the New York Times, leading up the investigation, looking at the relationships between corporate cash, lobbyists, and state attorneys general, including Florida's Pam Bondi. Sergio Bustos, the political editor with the Miami Herald, also joining us. Greg is now on the program from Delray Beach. Greg, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Two checks have arrived back to us this month. One about 3 weeks ago for a refund to the Florida prepaid plan that we put in money back in 2008. And the other one is a check that came from Pam Bondi for settlement on the LCD screens. You guys familiar are with the first one, I'm sure, with the prepaid.
Sure.
And the coincidences are too weird, because for the last 3 years, nothing happened with Chris's office to get us the money back, and then January they put in the money for the changes.
Are you, the timing of the arrival of these checks ahead of Election Day is curious to you? That's your question at this point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not going to be swayed by it, but I could just imagine many people say, oh, look what came in, and there's Pam Bondi's note all over the one, and Governor Scott taking credit for the other.
Greg, in Delray Beach, we appreciate it. Sergio, how about it? Any curiosity about the timing of those refund checks to the voter in Delray Beach, Greg?
We wrote about this a couple weeks back, and in fact, I myself got the prepaid letter from the Florida prepaid program, along with another letter written by Governor Scott announcing that they had gotten us the money. That was a effort done by the legislature that, again, Scott took some credit for, but the timing was, as we wrote in the story, was interesting in that it was only coming weeks before the election and right at the time of early voting.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just prepaid. There were other different kind of state agencies were announcing changes that either benefited someone's pocketbook or benefited consumers in general. And there was some wording or some kind of letter or other material enclosed with either an email or even the letter itself to show and to give credit to Governor Scott.
Now, it may seem like those two issues, these checks that Greg talks about and Sergio you've reported on, and the issue that Eric Lipton covers in the New York Times are completely separate, but they come to the issue of perception. And that's why I wanted Greg to kind of ask his question. Perception. I mean, Eric, you're in Washington with the New York Times looking at all these state attorneys general and relationship with lobbyists. The perception that I suppose the legal industry has as it is addressing these state attorneys general and the evolution of how corporations are thinking of these top prosecutors, again, as political animals, not simply prosecutors.
I mean, I think that the thing is that an attorney general has subpoena power. They're law enforcement officers. They're prosecutors in many places. They actually have criminal prosecution powers in many states. So they're not, I mean, everyone has to get elected. You need to raise money in order to get elected. But if you're an attorney general, you're different. You know, it's imagine the attorney general of the United States or a U.S. attorney, you know, as a prosecutor, doing things like similar to what the attorney generals are doing. It's sort of hard to imagine. And so I just think that, you know, all of this is not to say that Pam Bondi or that anyone else that I've written about is broken the law. And I'm not asserting that she has. And I don't know that she's done anything really, you know, purely wrong. I can't prove it. But clearly, if you have the subpoena power, you need to be very careful with the money that you take, the places you go, the people you hang out with. And I think that you know, as this has evolved, perhaps there's not as much appreciation of that.
Eric, I got to ask, what's the second day lead for you on this? I can't imagine with the you know, more than 100 pages of documents you released with this that it's over for you.
There's more to come. I'm still buried in documents, and there's definitely more to come.
All right, Eric Lipton, investigative reporter with the New York Times. Sergio Bustos, political editor with the Miami Herald. Always great to speak with you, Sergio. It is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. We've got plenty more to come. 5 years ago this Halloween, Scott Rothstein was in Morocco as his Ponzi scheme in South Florida was collapsing. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening. 5 years ago this week, a plane with Scott Rothstein on it landed in Morocco. Now, 2 weeks earlier, Rothstein had sent lawyers working at his law firm a research assignment. What countries did not have extradition agreements with the U.S. or Israel? It was collapsing. Rothstein's riches, that is, millions of dollars in real estate, the boats, the yachts, the cars, the watches, the restaurant on Las Olas, even the call girls, all of it was unraveling, and unraveling fast 5 years ago. On Halloween, Rothstein sent a text to his law firm's five partners, quote, "Sorry for letting you all down. I am a fool," end quote. That was 5 years ago. Julie Kay with the Daily Business Review joins us here on the Florida Roundup. Julie, it may have been 5 years ago. The case continues to generate charges, though, even 5 years on. Just this month, for instance, the former executive with TD Bank, the bank used by Rothstein in the scheme, was arrested. Give us a quick reminder of how this scheme worked.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thanks for having me on. And I wanted to say, it's unbelievable that it's been 5 years and that we're still writing stories. Yeah. And I looked back and saw that I wrote 150 stories on this with my byline. Mm. This has been a gift for South Florida newspapers. Yeah.
And for the legal industry, too, for lawyers.
For the legal industry. Yeah. I mean, that's what I find really interesting and ironic is that while one of the legacies is that this has cast a bit of a black eye on the legal industry, it's also been a boon to the legal industry, and the lawyers are admitting this. I mean, sure. This came right at the time. Who would have thought that? I imagine Scott almost laughing in jail, thinking, you know, I've really helped out the legal community.
Well, think about the economy and what things were going through in Halloween of 2009. I mean, the housing collapse was potentially at its lowest point. Jobs were being destroyed nationwide, and certainly here in Florida by the thousands almost every week. It was a very difficult environment, and here comes along this very complex legal case, and certainly assisting that kind of thing. But again, how did it work? How did he dupe so many people out of so much money?
I mean, it's still unbelievable to me that these, allegedly sophisticated investors would invest in this. But this is basically, and I'm still understanding things, but basically what would happen, and because he had the veneer, he was a lawyer.
Yep.
He had his office. If you've been in his office, there were pictures all over the walls of him with John McCain and him, you know,
he had a big ego wall. We call that an ego wall.
And
right.
So, you know, and he's a lawyer, and I believe he was board certified. So there was, you know, that was unusual for a Ponzi scheme. I think there's only been one other involving a lawyer.
But this came on the heels of Bernie Madoff, who was an investment professional seeped in financial services. This was something much different. This was out of the legal community. This was not an investor or a high flying trader from Wall Street. This was a legal eagle from Las Olas.
That's right. That's right. Who has never had a big legal career. He never did. I knew I've been covering law for 14, 15 years, and I did cover the Broward courts at one time. And I knew a lot of his partners. And, you know, of course, afterwards, they all said, we didn't know anything about this.
Of course
but,
not.
You know, Russell
right.
Adler, who I was a source of mine for years, is now in prison. But I'll try to give you very simply how because that's all I understand about how it worked, was that he was a labor employment lawyer. And so there's settlements that are coming through, but they're not coming through yet. You have to wait for them. So he'll say, you know, I need the money. We're gonna get the settlement. When the settlements come in, you're gonna get 30-40% on this. It's a structured settlement. It comes in, but this is the interesting part. These are all confidential settlements because they're labor and employment and harassment. And so I can't show you the papers. But, you know, let's not forget what is so unbelievable and unprecedented about this case is that this was the first time a bank, and this is no small bank, TD Bank,
yeah.
was found complicit in this.
And this is significant because just the charges just this month, again, 5 years after this this Ponzi scheme collapsed, almost $1.5 billion. This is a significant failure on the part of watchdogs, obviously. But TD Bank, the executive, Frank Spinoza, accused of propping up the Ponzi scheme with these lock letters. How did those work?
I mean, as I understand it, they were letters verifying that he did have accounts there. And he
yep.
did have, you know, from what I mean, and from some of the charges that I've seen, I mean, he and others who have not been charged, and by the way, we're now finding out, or there's been hints that the 5-year statute of limitations may be raised to 10 years because banks are involved. So we all were holding our breath. Oh, this, you know, kind of the story's going to be over, but it may not be. But yeah, and then supposedly there was there's another bank involved, Gibraltar Bank, much smaller bank, which really was hurt because they couldn't afford the $400 million that I believe TD Bank. But there are allegations that, you know, some bank executives, lower level executives, would actually meet in the parking lot with Scott, mm-hmm. that they would have little shows where they'd go in the conference room of the bank and show a actual balance sheet for Scott. So, I mean, it went pretty deep there. Yeah.
What's the legacy 5 years on and with the potential of five more years before the statute of limitations expires?
Well, I quickly...
Rothstein's in jail, 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. He's gone, but he's still talking, apparently. I mean, that's another thing, by the way, that... No one has ever... Bernie Madoff, I was talking to someone, I said, well, what's... Aside from the fact that was so much huger. I mean, that was $17 billion, I believe. But that case was never so interesting. I mean, we didn't have all this other stuff with, you know, prostitutes.
We didn't have the yachts and the call girls and the restaurant.
It was kind of boring. Yeah, yeah. But someone also pointed out to me that he didn't sing. Madoff did not... He didn't sing. He didn't flip on anyone. He just took it. He went. But because, you know, Scott is singing, and a lot of other lawyers and defendants are also flipping on others. But as far as a legacy, you know, I pondered that last night, and you know, whether it's left a black eye on, you know, the legal community, I think there's a very short memory. We're the Ponzi capital of
we're
the
still
country.
In South Florida. We have a very low threshold.
And someone said to me, let's hope that people are smarter next time and before they invest millions of dollars. But who knows? You know, there's always, when you promise someone, you know, 50% returns, they have a short memory.
Yeah. In the meantime, Rothstein does remain in jail. There have been, two dozen charges, I think, brought up with the case. Prosecutors continue looking into it. And, of course, investors trying to continue to claw back dollars.
Yes. And there's, you know, one of the biggest lawyers who represented dozens of the richest investors, Bill Scheer. He has a massive lawsuit pending against Bank of America. I was talking to him about that this morning, and I said, well, did they actually have Rothstein money? Because I've always been just knowing that there's two banks, TD and Gibraltar. He said, well, he's claiming that Rothstein, that day that it imploded, was opening accounts at Bank of America, and Bank of America was more than willing. We want to give the Bank of America, when we write our story, you know, their full chance to defend.
Sure.
You're talking major money with Bank of America.
Well, certainly, and think of what Bank of America was going through in 2009. It was still swallowing up the countrywide buyout, and of course, the Merrill Lynch challenges that it has, and is obviously run into trouble with its mortgages.
And if we have another minute, I'd like to, real quick, I want to also mention the whole legacy of the Broward Sheriff's Office, which has had its share of scandals over the years. This was a huge one that they apparently, I've heard, tightened up their off-duty details. So that they, you know, what happened where they actually helped him pack his bags for Morocco.
Yep.
That's not going to happen again, we hope.
Well, certainly not. But if so, Julie Kay is on the case. No doubt about it.
I'll
Thank you
there.
So much. Yes,
Thank you.
Daily Business Review with Julie Kay. Finally here on the Roundup, how about the cobwebs and the creaky floorboards? Maybe the shadows lurking in the corner, the eerily empty hallways. It all has the features of a great haunted house, doesn't it? But today, it's the marbled lobby, the panoramic views, and the iconic tower. There was a time when the Biltmore Hotel in Coral Gables could have passed for that spooky haunted house. Here's WLRN's Julia Duba.
Do you believe in ghosts? Spirits from beyond?
In the early 1970s, the Biltmore Hotel was an abandoned shell, and it was creepy.
The supernatural world may not be as far as you think. In fact, it may only be as far as the Coral Gables Biltmore Hotel.
This audio is from the late 80s, from a documentary about the legends and the ghosts of the Biltmore. The hotel's abandoned years were crucial to its haunted reputation.
All the kids would always talk about, oh, there must be ghosts in there.
Betsy Skip grew up in Coral Gables and used to sneak into the Biltmore with her friends. Local kids like Skip knew some of the Biltmore's history, the glamour of the 20s and 30s, how it became a World War II hospital, how people died there. In 1952, the old hotel became the temporary home to the University of Miami Medical School. When UM opened its own medical school, the Biltmore was left empty. That's when kids started sneaking in.
Julia Duba reporting for us here on this Halloween, and that is the Halloween, the Election Eve edition of Florida Roundup here on the 31st day of October. It is produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Julia Duba. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our executive producer at WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Technical supervision by Paul Leary. Thank you, Paul. Ed Bell and South Florida Arts Beat is next Monday morning at 9 a.m. The Sunshine Economy on Election Eve will get you ready to vote if you haven't yet. To all the ghouls and goblins, have a wonderful and safe Halloween. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.